Here's some numbers for you. Over the past 40 years, 35% of all income gains went to the richest 1% of Americans, while the overall income gap has widened. 35% of all income gains to the richest 1%. From 1979 to 2006, the top 1% received 36% of all gains in household income, even taking into account employer-sponsored health insurance, federal taxes, and government benefits. Between 2001 and 2006, it got worse. 53% of income gains went to the top 1%. Over half of the income gains from 2001 to 2006, that great bubble that preceded the recession, over 50% went to the top 1%. Between 79 and 2005, now get this, the top 0.1%. That's one out of every 1,000 households in America received over 20% of all after-tax income gains. The bottom 60% received 13.5%. Think the worst of banana republics. The top 300,000 people got 1.5 times the total income growth for the bottom 180 million. Why do the have-it-alls have so much more, and how have they managed to restructure the economy to reap the lion's share of the gains and shift the cost downward, tearing new holes in the safety net and saddling all of us with increased debt and risk? Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson put the blame squarely on government for aiding the rich and not doing enough to safeguard the interests of the middle class. The winner-take-all economy, they say, is primarily a result of the winner-take-all politics practiced in America. And, no surprise to listeners of this show, partisan politics has made little difference as inequality in wealth has remained constant during both Republican and Democratic administrations. But this national drift toward the concentration of power in the hands of a small group of super wealthy individuals has affected the parties differently. The Republicans have been empowered to pursue their agenda full speed ahead, while the Democrats are too often left to negotiate with themselves between their espoused principles and the wishes of their key funders. This has been going on so consistently for so long that we may have stopped asking this question. How, in a country where public officials must regularly face voters at the polls, could this have happened? And I'll be asking that question as well as this one. What, if anything, can we do to turn things around? My two guests today, Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson, as I said, are the authors of Winner Take All Politics. Hacker is the Stanley B. Reser Professor of Political Science at Yale University and is the author of The Great Risk Shift, The New Economic Insecurity and the Decline of the American Dream, and The Divided Welfare State. Paul Pearson is Professor of Political Science and holder of the Avis Saint Chair of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley. He's the author of Politics in Time and Dismantling the Welfare State. Together, they have authored Off-Center, The Republican Revolution and the Erosion of American Democracy, as well as Winner Take All Politics. Welcome Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson.
Thanks so much for having us on.
Okay. I like listeners to get a bit of a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we end up talking about. So Jacob first, and then Paul, can you tell us a bit about your path to the work you're doing today? And don't be afraid to go back a bit to cite mentors or moments of decision along the way so people get a sense of who you are. Jacob.
Well, first, I should say that Paul and I actually have been working together for almost a decade now, but we actually have a connection that goes way back. We both were born and grew up in Eugene, Oregon, about a decade apart from each other, and we didn't know that until after we had known each other for quite a while. And I think that helps explain why the two of us really sort of have a very congruent outlook on things and work together well. So I've been working on issues surrounding economic security and inequality really since I started as a political scientist. And, the puzzle that I've been grappling with is really why the United States has seen a real erosion of both economic security and economic equality over the last generation. And initially, my interest was really in those policies that provide economic security, health care, retirement, pensions. But as I watched what was happening there, I mean, with employers cutting back, with real strains being faced by many Americans, I really saw a larger theme emerge, and that's that our politics seems increasingly incapable of really responding to the concerns of the middle class. And so with Paul, I started delving much more deeply into this side of the story, And that's really the genesis of Winner Take All Politics. You know, Paul and I worked on a book about 5 years ago about the degree to which we thought, you know, our government was pulling away from the public, and in particular was moving to the right while Americans were mostly staying in the middle. But I didn't really know it then, but I was actually asking the bigger question about why there's been such a divorce between where Americans are on many of these issues over the last generation and the real strains Americans are facing on the one hand and where our government is on the other.
Okay, that's the voice of Jacob Hacker. Let me ask you one other question, Jacob, before I turn to Paul, and that is that, as you mentioned, for a while you were concentrating on sort of smaller issues within the larger picture. One of the places I think I first came in contact with you was that your proposal sort of for Medicare for All was really a very sensible proposal. How long ago did you come up with that, and God, don't we wish that had been the program?
Yeah, so that was a long time ago as well. I actually wrote the first proposal that became what was known as the public option during the health care reform debate back in 2001. And the idea was pretty simple, that either we were going to make Medicare part of the solution, or increasingly people were going to understand Medicare as the problem. And that's certainly what's happened. You know, the fact is that the Medicare program has lowered administrative costs, has done a better job of controlling costs, and is a really vital foundation of economic security. When you compare it with the private insurance sector, it's been much more capable. It surely needs improvement, but one argument that I was making consistently over the last 10 years or so is that instead of really tearing down Medicare, as Republicans now want to, we really should be expanding it and making it work better, and that this sort of unbridled faith that the private sector would be able to deal with the strains in healthcare was really misplaced. And, you know, it was quite a fight in 2009 and 2010, and I was deeply involved in it. I'm very happy that there was a major piece of healthcare reform legislation passed, but, you know, like many Americans, I think that the legislation does not go far enough to really address the concerns people have about economic security and rising healthcare costs. And, you know, that's, in some ways, I was writing this book as I was involved in that debate, and I think that the writing the book about how our politics had changed kind of provided me with some perspective on why it was so hard to fight for this relatively modest idea that Americans should have the ability, if they want, to join the same program that provides economic security to older Americans.
Yeah, I know. I was saying during that whole debate, start at lowering it to 55, and then when that gets, you know, when that gets settled in, then drop it to 50. When that gets settled in, drop it to 45. Way too rational in a politics that is, as you guys point out so well in this book, so dominated by either the very, very rich or the very rich corporations. And of course, the thing I bewail is that when you make the deals you make and end up with, let's say, inadequate or partway solutions, whether in the stimulus program or healthcare, or if something happens in energy, then if it doesn't succeed, people say, see, and they say, let's quickly throw out the baby with the bathwater. Second guest now, Paul Pearson, a little bit about your path to the work you're doing nowadays.
Go back to childhood and family. I think for a lot of us, that's where our politics and our social awareness comes from. And I was raised in a family where social justice issues were an important part of the way that we looked at the world. I spent a lot of time in a progressive Protestant church, and, you know, the parts of the New Testament that speak to having compassion and consideration for those less fortunate, you know, that was an important part of my upbringing, and I think it carried into my work as an adult. I would say, in terms of the work with Jacob, the writing that we've been doing over the last decade or so, the really key moment, and it's still a highly relevant moment, I think, was the Bush tax cuts of 2001, which was, you know, one of the most important, maybe the most important piece of legislation in the last 30 years or so. And Jacob and I, we were talking about it, and both had the same reaction to it, which was, that when you really look at that piece of legislation, it was like a subprime mortgage, the way in which it was designed. I mean, it was an attempt to make voters think that they were buying one thing when in fact what they were getting was something altogether different, and something that was just weirdly designed in all sorts of ways. We can go into some of the details about it. Where you look at the design, you can say the only reason that they would set it up this way is because they're trying to manipulate voters so that they see some aspects of what they're doing, but much of the most important stuff and the stuff that is most favorable to the affluent is hidden. And we're still living with the repercussions of that today. It's been an astonishing political success, the Bush tax cuts, even though, you know, now most Americans at least would like to see the tax cuts for the upper-ended groups abolished. But, you know, I think in a way you could draw a direct line from the kind of deception in the that's built into the Bush tax cuts to the kind of deception that's built into the Ryan budget proposals that the House just passed, which are, I would say, an even more radical document than the Bush tax cuts, and are also being sold with a set of arguments which really hide what's going on.
Yeah.
So that was what, you know, I think Jacob and I were both motivated by just trying to understand how such a radical piece of legislation as the Bush tax cuts could be passed, how it could be successfully designed without really the media much noticing, or voters really getting a chance to notice, designed in such a way to present itself as a piece of legislation for everyone, but in fact being designed in a way that it really favored the groups that were already benefiting the most from the American economy.
Yeah, and if I remember anything that the media featured during that debate, what there was of a debate, was Alan Greenspan pointing to the surplus that had accrued under Clinton and pointing out how dangerous that would be in the future, and that these tax cuts were actually good for economic health. And as I recall, that was like the biggest story of that whole debate.
Yeah, and that's an astonishing example, and we could spend an hour just exploring the dynamics of that fateful fight. But yes, you had, you know, the supposedly neutral head of the Federal Reserve, you know, who had been on Clinton to cut the deficit, you know, and it pushed very hard to get Democrats to cut the deficit. And then when Republicans came in, he provided what was, you know, I think in retrospect you'd have to say just the shoddiest, most dissembling defense of, the huge hole that they were going to cut in the budget with the tax cuts, by saying that we really had to worry about the problem that the federal government was going to completely retire the federal debt.
Right.
I mean, it's
and you know, what's so funny to me is the analogy that the tax cut folks, the deficit hawks, and the Republican Party make. You know, think of it like your own home. They certainly weren't saying that then. Think about your own home. What if you ended up with a surplus you couldn't get rid of?
Right.
Okay, I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson, professors at Yale and Berkeley, respectively, and authors together of Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. Both of you, I like to give out websites to folks so they can follow up on your work. As I looked around, I didn't see any for either of you in particular, so I would say go to yale.edu for Hacker, berkeley.edu for Pearson, and maybe Huffington Post for articles you both do. You have other references I should?
Well, Simon & Schuster has a lot of information about the most recent book.
Okay, that's true.
On their website.
Yeah, so if you go to Winner Take All Politics on the Simon & Schuster site, they've got excerpts, they've got reviews, and things like that. So you heard me in the intro, I think, lay out some of what I thought were some of the most egregious numbers that you guys pay attention to. I've got a lot of detailed questions, but just anything you want to add to the numbers I cited in that intro?
Well, let me just kind of give the big picture here.
Great. It
builds off of what Paul was talking about with the Bush tax cuts. I mean, we've seen a remarkable period in which there's been both a dramatic increase in the share of income going to the very richest of Americans, as we show in the book, about 40% of all household income gains between 1979 and 2007, even after you take into account taxes and federal and private benefits, 40% of all household income gains have gone to the richest 1% of Americans, and the gains are a lot bigger at the very top. So we've seen this big development, and the argument that Paul and I make is that this is not driven by some inexorable economic trend beyond the control of policymakers. It's not due to globalization or technological change by themselves, but rather it's really due to what government has done to tilt the playing field in favor of those at the top. And so we're really grappling with a puzzle of trying to understand, first, how that happened, and second, why it happened, as you put it in your opening. And I think the conclusion that we came to as we did this work and increasingly, you know, looked at these numbers and looked at the history is that this has a lot to do with a real imbalance in our politics between the middle class, broadly construed, and those at the very top, particularly corporations, Wall Street, and the very affluent, who've gained enormous influence in our politics, even as middle-class Americans have lost a lot of the traditional sources of political voice they once had. So it's really trying to understand why that's happened, and as you said, to think a little bit about how it might be changed. That's really the reason we wrote the book.
One of the formats that I use sometimes on the show, and in the back of my head, it's the format for this particular one, is really the way your book is set up, which is it's broke, let's fix it. And it's three questions. What's the evidence that it's broken? And that's in the numbers. What's the causes? What's the history? How did it get broken? That's the middle of the book. And then what do we do to fix it is at the end of that book. And basically this interview will follow that. One thing I wanted to ask, and Paul, why don't you take this one, is for people just to remember, this current situation that has been exaggerated almost consistently since actually, you point out it starts prior to Reagan, it starts under Carter. It has not always been so. For the generation following World War II, prosperity was broadly distributed up and down the income ladder. We had countervailing forces, and this is, in some sense, the golden age that the right and the Tea Party are constantly looking back to, despite the fact that it's the opposite of what their program is.
Right. So if you look at the post-war period up until the mid-1970s, and we call this broadland, just to contrast it with the current era, which I think can be more aptly called Richistan. But during the era of broadland, what was striking is exactly as you say, that there was tremendous economic growth during this period, much higher than the rate of growth since then. But the fruits of that growth were very widely spread. Now, that doesn't mean that the United States was Sweden. It wasn't an especially egalitarian country. And it wasn't even becoming more equal during this period. It's just that everybody's income was going up at about the same rate. So it really was a kind of rising tides lift all boats kind of story, which is just starkly different from the situation that's taken place since the 1970s, where overwhelmingly the gains have gone to those in the top 1%. And if you look at the rather meager gains in income that those below the top 1% have made, most of that is accounted for just by the fact that they're working more hours, not that they're actually getting paid more for what they do. So the contrast could not be starker.
And do you agree with the sort of sick irony of it that so much of the talk is let's go back to those better times, and that those better times were actually the times when labor had power, when wealth was spread, when the super rich were not out of this world, when we were not looking more and more like a banana republic or an oligarchy, and this goes back a little bit to what you said at the top, which is that the media and the public really seem to miss what's going on.
Well, right. I mean, it's a little unclear with the contemporary GOP exactly how far they want to go back to the, you know, the supposedly, you know, the better past. These days it feels like they really want to go back to the late 19th century. I mean, they're attacking not just the Great Society War on Poverty programs of the 60s, but, they're now attacking core New Deal programs and actually, you know, there are those who want to challenge the idea that senators should be directly elected and
true.
That we should have an income tax. So, I think their golden age keeps on receding further and further into America's past.
Let me piggyback on that and ask you to continue, because one thing you point out in the book is that this period, this current period of enormous and destructive inequality is not unique in U.S. history.
Well, that's right. I mean, so... We now have, thanks to the efforts of a couple of outstanding economists, one of whom is a colleague of mine at Berkeley, Emmanuel Saez, and his co-researcher Thomas Piketty, who's at a French university, they've collected very detailed evidence on income distribution in the United States going all the way back to the early 1900s that allows you to look at not just the broad stretches of the income distribution, but especially at the people at the very top, the top 1% or 10th of 1% or 100th of 1%. And as you say, what that shows is that the levels of, you know, acute concentration of income at the top that we're seeing now, they're not unprecedented. And the time we saw this before was in the 1920s. It was right before the Great Depression, where you saw a lot of trends that were similar to what we witnessed lately, especially the huge expansion of the banking sector, massive increases in speculation, and with that a sharp concentration of income.
And of course, when we're looking at history, what we see is that everything's out of whack. There's a crash. And then there are repairs. And I think what is so sad here, and I remember I interviewed David K. Johnston a couple of weeks ago, the expert on taxes, and it turned out he had been my guest on the day of Obama's inauguration back in 2009. And we had both talked about, well, now finally, you know, isn't this great? We got a progressive president at a time of economic crisis. We can actually make some, you know, the country might be ready to actually make some real repairs. Only that doesn't seem to be happening this time with nearly the effectiveness, either one of you.
Well, I think that's part of the way in which you can be misled by the historical analogies as well as informed by them. I mean, I think there are two crucial differences between the early 20th century and today that help us understand what's going on. The first is just to note that in the early 20th century, a lot of that money was in the hands of a few capitalists, and a lot of it also was in land and inherited wealth. In the last 25 or 30 years, what we've seen, and this is what the work of Saez and Piketty that Paul mentioned has shown, is that we've seen basically the rise of a super rich class that is mostly in the executive world. Financial executives and non-financial executives together make up about 6 in 10 of the richest 0.1% of taxpayers. And so that's a pretty big difference. So the Great Depression basically wiped out a lot of that accumulated wealth. And this crash has really not shaken in any fundamental way the sources of income at the very top, which are really rooted in a free-for-all financial market on the one hand and an out-of-control corporate compensation system on the other hand. We in the book really show that those two sets of policies, financial market policies and corporate governance policies, have tilted dramatically in favor of the richest. And there's really been only a very modest attempt to try to redress the balance. So there's no natural reason that this time around we're going to see a real shift. And the second reason for that is that, you know, the last 2 years have really shown that the kind of politics that we describe in the book, which we call winner-take-all politics, where organized representatives of these narrow economic interests have a great deal of influence and the broad middle class really has a lot less of an ability to shape what government is doing, that kind of politics is still very strong. President Obama on almost every major issue, take the fight over health care reform that I was involved in, but also look at financial market regulation, look at energy reform, look at the fight over the stimulus package. On all those fronts, he had to fight a really, really committed and strong conservative Republican coalition on the one hand, and then he also had to fight these organized economic interests that have vast lobbying resources and are really invested in trying to preserve this sort of tilted set of policies that we describe in the book. So, history sometimes repeats itself, but at least it seems to me that we're in the point where history is repeating itself as tragedy and not as farce, and that this is really a period in which a lot of the strains that you would think would produce a real push for a new set of policies have not yet broken through the kind of embedded and deeply entrenched winner-take-all politics that we describe in our book.
Yeah, very good. Thank you for pointing out the difference in the remaining power of the super wealthy after the crash of 29 and after the recession of 2007-2008. I hadn't realized that distinction. These are the voices, by the way, of Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson, collaborators on the book Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. I just want to set up a little bit of your discussion of the how this happened. You've referred to it a few times that winner take all politics in some sense is a new situation, in the way that the organizational and the financial capacity of, one side seems to so outweigh the other side. And, one of the things that I also, thought of as you were just speaking was an interview Bill Moyers did with Thomas Frank. On the one-year anniversary of Obama's election, and he goes through Frank goes through all the compromises that were made, all the negotiations that happened before the negotiations even start, and so on key things. And finally, Moyer says, "Well, why don't the Democrats make this case? Why don't they fight harder? Why don't they set their goals higher?" And he said, "They don't want to upset their funders." And that really, I think in this next section, you will lay out that actually, the funders of both parties remain, the real powerful ones remain together. Let me just point out a couple of things. In 2008, and this is from your book, 69% of Americans agreed, 2008, 69% of Americans agreed that government is pretty much run by a few big interests looking out for themselves rather than for the benefit of all the people. Only 29% disagreed. Now, in 1964, that's in the middle of that period we were talking about when wealth was shared and there were forces at play. The first year this question was asked by the American National Election Studies, the numbers were reversed. 64% disagreed, 29% agreed. The loss of faith is the most destructive legacy of a cynical right that has torn down government to gain power and a feeble center that has too often gone along. So you also briefly mentioned it, but I just want to point out to other people, others point to what's happened with the wealth in this country, and they blame it on globalization, on failures of our education system, et cetera, et cetera. You point out that those explanations are wrong. You point the finger at Washington and at politics, so take it away. How did this happen? Who wants to start, Jacob or Paul?
Well, pick up on the first subject of exactly what's happened to the politics, and then maybe Jacob could speak to this point about why we're not convinced by these arguments about globalization and changes in the distribution of skills and so on, the kinds of arguments that economists usually make. One of the central claims that we make in the book is that most of the discussion in the media, most of what pundits focus on about politics, is really misplaced because it puts elections and voters at the heart of the political system. We call this the politics of electoral spectacle, and the media tends to love it, and especially television, because you can focus on personalities, and you can treat it sort of like sports, you know, which team, is the red team winning, or is the blue team winning, how are their stars doing, and so on, make it about celebrities and that kind of contest. And we're not saying that these elections don't matter. They do matter a lot. It matters a lot whether you elect Republicans or Democrats. But there's a whole additional aspect of politics which, in terms of what government actually does, what actually happens in Washington, is even more important. And we call that the politics of organized combat, that the organized have huge advantages over the disorganized in politics because they can develop the kind of sustained focus and expertise that you need to really figure out how to push the levers in Washington, put pressure on policymakers to respond. Or in many cases, what these organized groups are trying to do is just to stop things from happening, to stop Washington from responding to economic problems. And, of course, that's a lot of what we saw once Obama came into office, was just organized groups pushing really hard to either water down or block possible reforms. So we really think that organized conflict is fundamental to understanding what's happened to Washington over the last 30 years. And it's very clear, and we provide the story in our book, it's very clear that there has been a sharp shift in the balance of organized power. And some of this has to do with the decline of the kind of groups that used to pay attention to middle-class economic interests, and organized labor is the most important factor here. Organized labor goes into steep decline beginning in the 1970s and accelerating from there with a lot of help from vigorous attacks by business and Washington basically saying that they weren't going to get involved in these conflicts and staying on the sidelines. And in addition to that, business mobilizes in the 1970s in a way that was totally unprecedented, really expanding not just the amount of money they put into politics, and money is important, but I think it's too much of a shorthand to say that this is about the fundraisers for the party, even though I think that's an important element of it. It's also just who is putting pressure on politicians, who is paying attention to what they are doing, who is rewarding them or punishing them for pursuing certain courses of action or for doing nothing. And it's that as much as it is about money. So that on too many cases, you take something like financial regulation, the attempt to do something to respond to, you know, the horrible failures of governance and regulation that contributed to the financial crisis, and there you have these incredibly mobilized financial interests. And on the other side, you have very little, and you know, very little to allow people to figure out how to have their interests protected and represented in the system.
Yeah, one thing, let me just cut in for a sec. One thing I often sense is that the public cares about financial regulation. It cares about environmental regulation. It cares about this and that. At about three or four in their priorities, you know, job, health, family, or education might be above that. Whereas with specific interests, it is their number one thing for which all their attention, all their energy, all their organization, all their money is going, and that is not a fair fight. Tell us a little bit about the Lewis Powell memo. And then I'm going to set this up so you can go on your own. But you point out that many put way too much importance on the changes, the cultural changes of 1968, while you suggest that perhaps 1978 is a much more crucial turning point. And might the highlights of that be the resounding defeat of the bill to establish a new Office of Consumer Representation and the failure of the labor bill that was the highest priority of labor at the time to even come to a vote? So whichever one wants to take that, the Powell memo and the 70s.
So I can go ahead and do that. Sometimes we're not sure who should. Don't want to trip over each other in responding.
Right.
But the contrast between the 60s and 70s, we think, is really illuminating. So people who think that elections are the thing on which all of American politics turns would typically identify 1968 as the turning point in American politics, right? So Nixon becomes, you know, the beginning of a stretch where Republicans mostly are winning presidential elections, where issues having to do with race and conflict over social issues are becoming more prominent in American politics. And so many people would say that's really when politics turned in the United States. But if you look at what was going on in Washington, especially with respect to domestic policy, that story just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I mean, as we point out, during the first half of the 1970s, with Nixon in the White House, you see the highest rate of social spending growth in the 20th century, higher than it was under LBJ. You see all sorts of new regulatory policies being adopted, the EPA being introduced, consumer protection policies, occupational safety policies. So a big, big expansion of regulation. And all of this is happening with a Republican in the White House. In many ways, if you look at the kinds of things that Nixon was willing to support in domestic politics, he looks to the left of, you know, many members of the contemporary Democratic Party.
Absolutely. I made that comparison during the Clinton years, and I think to some extent even Obama. It's just that the center has moved so much, and you're going to point out why.
Right. So then you turn to the late 1970s, when Carter is president and where Democrats control the House, the Senate, and the presidency, and all of a sudden things start to become much more conservative. By 1978, you see defeats of all the major pieces of domestic legislation. As you say, the proposal to have a consumer protection agency established, but also a really important fight over industrial relations reform, which would have made it easier for unions to organize, is successfully filibustered in the Senate. And then you start to get big tax cuts that are before Reagan comes into office, big cuts in the capital gains tax, big cuts in other taxes affecting high-income groups. So politics and policy is really shifting right in the middle of a Democratic administration. And we argue that a lot of this has to do with powerful mobilization of business in response to those trends that I was describing that were taking place under Nixon, in which, you know, liberals really seem descendant in Washington and in policymaking. And the Lewis Powell memo is this famous memo that he wrote in, I believe it's 1971. This is before he was on the Supreme Court, later appointed by Nixon. But at this point, he was working for the Chamber of Commerce, and he penned this memo that said, "We have got to get organized. That is how you get things done in Washington. We're on the defensive. If we want to be on the offensive, we have to be much more organized, have much more capacity for proactive behavior in Washington rather than just responding to things that have already happened." We don't want to suggest, some people suggest that the Powell memo was somehow the trigger for all this, and we see it as much more a symptom of much broader trends than the thing itself that changed things.
Sure, sure. One of the things you point out, by the way, I just want to mention to people, is in 1972, the National Association of Manufacturers moves its headquarters from New York to D.C.
Right, and the same, right, which is, I think, you know, a highly revealing action. They basically said, we realize now how important government is for us, and, you know, we want to be where the action is. And around the same time, you get the Business Roundtable forming, which is, you know, so the lobbying arm now for the very highest reaches of American business. So, you know, the very biggest companies. And it's basically an institution that is designed to bring the leverage of the CEOs of those companies directly to bear on politicians and policymakers in Washington. That's also taking shape in this period, along with a huge expansion of think tanks, political action committees, campaign contributions, and so on. So there's really a revolution in the balance of organized power that takes place in the 1970s, and that's why you can get, you know, much more progressive politics under a Nixon administration,
right,
than you get under a Democratic president a few years later.
And in some sense, it seems to me that what you had in Nixon was those people who think that culture rules rather than organization, was that the culture that had emerged in the 60s did want consumer protection, did want environmental protection, and so even a Republican goes along with it until business gets organized and says, Americans may want this, but it's not good for us.
Well, I think the thing I would add to this is that, you know, that was that moment when the organizational basis of what was happening in Washington shifted is really also the moment when economic inequality starts to take off in the United States. You know, we first start to see rises in inequality in a lot of the evidence in either the late 1970s or the early 1980s. And so the timing fits very closely with these organizational shifts that are happening in Washington. I think economists have generally been searching for some broad economic explanation that can really help us understand what happened in this period. And we're very skeptical that the changes that are occurring over this period, rather gradually in the economic environment, can really help really explain the precise way in which inequality rose in the United States. And I think one of the things that we were struck by as we started to look at the evidence and is that really what we're talking about is not a pulling apart of, you know, from the bottom third from the top third, but really a pulling away of the very rich from the rest of American society. That's really dramatic when you start to look toward the 1990s and 2000s. But even in the 1980s, you start to see the richest of Americans really moving up and the rest of Americans seeing their wages stagnate and their incomes get ahead only because they're working more hours. And the standard arguments tend to focus a lot on skills and these technological factors, but that doesn't help us very well explain what's happening at the very top. And there's another reason to be, I think, skeptical of the view that this was a sort of natural result of economic changes, and besides the fact that it fits very well with the changes that are happening in our politics, and that's that the United States isn't the only country that over this period is experiencing shifts in the economic environment, being more exposed to the international economy or seeing technological shifts in the workplace. But it is really the country that stands out as having the largest and most dramatic increase in this kind of top-heavy inequality. And I think that really calls on us to look at what's happening within the United States and the domestic politics of the United States, the kind of developments that Paul was just talking about. The last thing I would say is that part of the skepticism that government and politics play a big role in the rise in America's top-heavy inequality reflects the reality that a lot of this happened in what people were earning in the market. So it's one thing if, you know, government policy was shifting to tax the rich more lightly, which it did, by the way. I mean, Paul mentioned that in 1978 there was big cuts in the capital gains tax. If you look from the 1960s to the late 2000s, you see a dramatic drop in the very top tax rates. And the effective tax rates, what people actually are paying, are coming way down for the richest. And one way to think about this is we used to have a tax code that was very progressive at the top. So the richest 10% paid more than the rest of the society. The richest 1% paid more than the richest 10%. The top 0.1% paid even more, and so on. But lately, the evidence just keeps rolling in that actually the richest of Americans are paying much less than they used to, and sometimes less than middle-class Americans. The most recent statistics on the top 400 taxpayers suggest that they're paying a tax rate, an effective tax rate, that's not much different than what a two-income family, middle-income family, is paying. So there have been shifts in tax policy. There have been shifts in what government is doing to provide benefits. But a lot of these changes are really occurring before government taxes and benefits take effect. And we argue that those changes really reflect the way in which government responding to these new organized forces, business groups, Wall Street was starting to organize in the 1980s. Government basically responded by changing the market. So we saw a massive wave of financial deregulation, which enriched those on Wall Street, but also created great risks for the rest of our economy. We saw a sort of shift in industrial relations policy, starting with that 1978 fight, but continuing through the 1980s, where we saw the rights of workers to organize being much less strongly enforced and sometimes explicitly cut back. And then we saw a lot of changes in accounting rules and the way in which corporate governance was policed that abetted this rise at the very top. And perhaps most important, we also saw Washington increasingly just not responding when these shifts in the economy and changes in what people were doing in the private sector were increasing the rewards for those at the top. So sometimes it was the government was changing the rules, but sometimes it was that Washington policymakers, encouraged by lobbyists to not do anything, we're basically sitting on their hands and saying, oh, we're not going to update the accounting rules. We're not going to deal with stock options that are being received by CEOs. And when you start to add that together, it's remarkable how much of the explosion of incomes at the top you can explain. And that helps us understand why the United States is really where this has happened more than almost any other country. It's also the case that the United States, it looks like other countries like Britain and Canada look more like the United States. And when you start to unpack what happened in their politics, they actually have done some of the same policy shifts. They've shifted their exposure to the economy, the global economy, in similar ways as the United States has. So I think once you think about the role that politics and policy plays, you really have a much more powerful understanding of how our society has changed and why. You really begin to see that it's not so much about redistribution, but it's about pre-distribution, about the way in which politics and policy is shaping opportunities for private actors to earn massive rewards and often to shift risks and costs onto the rest of Americans So government has basically helped create this winner-take-all economy.
Very good. One of the things you talk about, and you mentioned there a couple of times just then, is that it's not just the headlines that go to a big bill, that whether it's passed or not, what form it takes, but you call it a drift, that basically inaction in the face of needed action may account for even more than the stuff that gets the attention. I'm Terrence McNally, speaking with Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson, professors at Yale and Berkeley, respectively, authors of Winner-Take-All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. You can learn more at simonandschuster.com or for Jacob Hacker, yale.edu, and for Paul Pearson, berkeley.edu. I did want to just echo what you were just saying. A big focus of mine over the last year is the dark side of American exceptionalism. Whether it's Stephen Hill's book, Europe's Promise, Tom Gagin's book, Was I Born on the Wrong Continent, or just kind of an attention, or the spirit level by Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett that indicates that countries with the most inequality score poorly on almost everything from public health to education and even things that your Ayn Rand followers would say wouldn't be true, which is even innovation and patents and so on. So I try to draw attention to the differences between the U.S. and the other wealthy nations. Unlike what Margaret Thatcher said, there are alternatives, and other nations have found better ways to function in the same general environment we face. And I find American ignorance, whether it's the public or the media, and certainly our politicians, ignorance and purposeful ignoring these differences almost pathological. Any thoughts? I mean, this has to be something that stares you guys in the face too.
Yeah, I think that is a very striking feature of American culture that the media strongly reinforces. Not all the media, because we're involved in media right now, but the almost presumption that we have lots to teach other countries, but nothing to learn from them, and the unwillingness to even take a quick look at other countries to see whether they are in fact experiencing the same problems that we are, and perhaps those problems aren't as severe, and so we might want to try to learn something from that and see how they're tackling those problems. It is really striking. I think just to take probably the most obvious example, Jacob could speak to this with more authority than I, but it would be healthcare.
Yep.
We spend vastly more than other countries do without achieving better outcomes. And we're bankrupting the country. Not just the government, right? The conservative response to this at this point is, if healthcare costs are going up too much, let's not do anything about healthcare costs. Let's just not have the government pay for anything anymore. But the idea that you might actually be able to learn from other countries who are managing this problem far more successfully than we are is not something that is seriously entertained.
Right, and one of the reasons that an American manufacturer has a greater inducement to shift work overseas is because he's paying the healthcare costs if the car is made here or the parts are made here versus the countries he's competing with who are not.
That's right, or it's going to show up in lower wages. Right? If you have to pay those expenses, then you're going to cut the compensation that you're going to be able to provide for your workers in other ways.
Yeah, I hear we are in agreement about this. It is driving me a bit crazy that even progressives, or as you point out, you say economists looked at, is it globalization? Is it education? Is it skills and so on? Well, if they matched our response to other countries in similar conditions response, they would, I would think, come to a similar conclusion to you have, that when you factor that in, those other explanations lose their power.
Well, we need to be just a little careful here. We're not saying that we don't think that globalization matters.
Oh, no.
Or that technological change matters. We do think those things matter. But we don't think that they provide at all a complete explanation for what is going on, and that there are these quite distinctive changes in the United States, especially the extent to which the gains from economic change have fallen into the laps of a very small group of people. That is distinctly American.
Okay. I'm Terrence McNally speaking with Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson, authors of Winner Take All Politics. We've got about 5 minutes. The future, the solution, what do you see? And let me just go back to the way you guys actually have set it up, which is that it's not just about the money. It's not just about lobbying. It's about organization. And has the organization of the people, labor, et cetera, has decreased, the organization of the very wealthy and the corporate have increased. How are we going to turn things around?
Well, it's a big question, obviously, to do in 5 minutes. But I think the three arguments of our book that really speak to what might be possible in the future are that a lot of this has occurred in the structure of our markets, not just through taxes and transfers, not just through government redistributing income. The second thing, as you said, is there a lot of this has occurred because government isn't capable of acting or isn't willing to act because it's not facing enough pressure to do so. The drift that's occurred in our policy. And I'll just note here that, you know, one of the really big developments that we talk about in the book is how the filibuster has essentially become a quasi-constitutional aspect of American politics, requiring that every piece of legislation besides the budget has to achieve a 60-vote supermajority in the Senate. That just makes it very hard for us to effectively respond to many of the economic and social challenges we face. But above all, I think this is really an organizational story, so any effort to address it will be an organizational response. And, you know, what we've seen in the past when we've seen effective movements for change is a kind of marrying of inside strategies of reformers who are working within government and outside strategies of groups that are mobilizing the public. And I think we're starting to see the first stirrings of that. You know, this is the same pattern we saw in the progressive era, and to some extent it's the same pattern that we're seeing on the conservative side in the Tea Party. But it's going to have to, of course, take a distinctive form in for progressives today. And I think the only way it will happen is if there's basically a strong emphasis on political reform, as we put it, changing the political rules of the game and getting a better balance of power in American politics is also going to change the economic rules of the game, because so much of what's happened is because of the decline in countervailing power within the market, not just within our politics. And then the second thing I would say is that there has to be a kind of long-term vision that places political and economic reform front and center. And so much of the back and forth in our politics today is very short-term oriented, you know, where, you know, Democrats pushed by funders, pushed by the sort of strategic moment, will embrace a set of, you know, reasonable responses to where their opponents are, but without much thought to how that's going to build support over the long term for fundamental reform.
Yeah, one of the quotes that you bring up that I have been bringing up during the Clinton years, during the Obama years, was the words attributed to FDR, "You've convinced me, now make me do it." And that takes organization. You want to add to that?
Well, the only thing that I would just underscore, and we had a recent op-ed piece in the Washington Post that people could track down on this, you know, the fight going on over public sector unions right now. I think it's extremely important for middle-class Americans to realize how crucial labor unions are for giving some expression to the economic concerns of ordinary Americans in Washington and in state houses. I think too often, sometimes unions are pursuing narrow interests, but too often we think that that's the most important or the only thing that they're doing. And they really have been and must continue to be a critical voice on these kinds of questions in American politics, or else you're only going to hear one side of the discussion, which is, you know, and too much of that has been happening for the last three decades.
Yeah. When I read your, you know, conclusion chapter and so on, and I was thinking, you know, you're laying out what needs to be done. I mean, here's just one. The aim should be threefold: to reduce the capacity of entrenched elites to block needed reform, filibuster, et cetera, to facilitate broader participation among those whose voices are currently drowned out, and to encourage the development of groups that can provide continuing organized capacity to mobilize middle-class voters and monitor government and politics in their behalf, and a media that pays attention to it. And I go, oh, you know, yes, but will it? And I guess that's something we're just going to have to watch, huh?
Yeah, Terrence, I mean, I think it's a huge challenge, but remember that the developments that we described took 30 years, and so it's not going to happen overnight. I think one of the things we're trying to do in the book is to really make clear what the problem is, because too often it's seen as a problem of that, you know, that Democrats don't have the right strategies for the current moment, or that somehow the messages or the framing aren't quite right. That is all very important, but much more fundamental is recognizing that the problem is that our politics is tilted dramatically toward those at the top, and that public policies and the rewards of our economy have followed. And if we're going to really have a new kind of politics, it's going to start with the recognition that we need to mobilize middle-class Americans to really push back against the kind of tilt of American politics that we describe in our book.
Okay, the book is Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. The authors are Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson, and you can learn more at Yale.edu for Hacker, Berkeley.edu for Pearson, and at SimonandSchuster.com. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others at any time during the week by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly for podcast articles and transcripts, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, you can go to TerrenceMcNally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com, both the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement of upcoming guests and issues, sign up at my site or email me at T.E. McNally, T.E. McNally at Mac.com.